From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Steve Norman reporting. The White House says it cannot conclude at this time that China-based hackers carried out the massive cyber attack on federal agency to collect data on millions of U.S. government employees. Spokesman Josh Earnest said Friday the FBI continues to investigate the security breach.
They are working actively to understand exactly the scope of this particular intrusion, but also to determine who is responsible and to make sure that we can take steps that are necessary to hold the individuals who are responsible for this incident.
Earlier, U.S. law enforcement officials said China-based hackers, possibly with links to China's government, were behind the attack. China's foreign ministry spokesman Hong Lei on Friday slammed the accusations as irresponsible. United Nations is urging all sides in the Ukraine conflict to fully respect the ceasefire agreement reached earlier this year. Ukraine's ambassador to the UN, Yuri Sergeyev, told the Security Council meeting Friday that Russia and Russia-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine were guilty of what he called grave violations of the ceasefire agreement. Russian Ambassador Vitaly Churkin accused Ukrainian forces of regularly shelling cities and villages in rebel-controlled areas. The UN's top human rights official says he's deeply concerned that no action has been taken over allegations that African Union peacekeepers killed 11 people in the Central African Republic last year. Said Raad al-Hussein said Friday that a full and transparent investigation has not been conducted. Central African Republic was hit by sectarian violence more than a year ago when a Christian militia was formed to combat the mostly Muslim rebels. This is VOA News. United States urging Rwanda not to make constitutional changes that would allow President Paul Kagame to run for a third term. In a statement on Friday to VOA's French to Africa service, the State Department said the U.S. believes democracy is best advanced by developing strong institutions, not strong men. Kagame has ruled Rwanda since the end of the 1994 genocide and has won two presidential elections, those in the years of 2003 and 2010. Annual World Economic Forum on Africa took place in Cape Town, South Africa this week. VOA's Anita Powell has our report.
For centuries, the African continent has been seen as an economic battlefield for its rich natural resources. But officials, investors, and business leaders have tried for 25 years to change that mindset at the annual World Economic Forum on Africa. Now the WEF is focused on another goal, making sure that Africa's economic growth impacts hundreds of millions of Africans who struggle to survive in chronic, grinding poverty. Elizabeth Littlefield is president and CEO of the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, a U.S. government organization that provides financing for private sector projects.
We're seeing more and more interest. One challenge that I'm quite interested in is how do we make sure that economic growth, which is so powerful in so much of the continent, benefits all of Africans, lifts up livelihoods, and improves lives.
Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Pakistani police official says 8 of the 10 men convicted and jailed for an attack on Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai for her activism for female education have been freed. In April, Pakistani officials said the 10 men had been found guilty of the planning and execution of the attack on Malala and were sentenced to at least 25 years in prison. They were the first convictions of the 2012 attack on Malala Yousafzai, who was 14 years old when she was shot on her way home from school in the Swat Valley. She survived and was airlifted for treatment to Britain, where she now resides. The Pakistan Taliban group claimed responsibility for the attack and said it would target Malala again if she were to ever return to Pakistan. A man in the U.S. state of Texas has been sentenced to almost 7 years in prison for planning to join the militant group Islamic State in Syria. 24-year-old Michael Todd Wolf, who called himself Farouk, was sentenced Friday by a federal court in Texas for attempting to provide material support to a designated terrorist organization. Wolf had arranged to meet with an FBI undercover employee who he believed would help him travel to Syria. Get more news at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Stephen Collinson, Senior Reporter at CNN Politics. And here are the issues. With new fighting in Ukraine, the European Union plans to renew its economic sanctions against Russia, which supports rebels in eastern Ukraine. In Washington, Congress passed legislation to take collection of metadata on phone calls out of the hands of the National Security Agency. And in Switzerland, Sepp Blatter, after winning a new term as president of FIFA, the international soccer, or as most people would say, football organization, announced he will step down as president. And in the United States, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has dipped in polls as she intensifies her campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2016. And Stephen, before we get to the Ukraine and Russia and the EU and all that, let me ask you just one question, because I know you've been home to England, and that is the United Kingdom, Great Britain, going to be not so great and not as united in the future?
That's a good question. We had an election last month, and David Cameron, the Conservative Prime Minister, won somewhat by default, because people, I think, decided that Ed Miliband, the Labour leader, wasn't fit to be Prime Minister. I have my doubts about the kind of political skill that Cameron has, but he's facing two huge questions now. He's called a referendum on whether Britain should be part of the European Union. Mm-hmm. And in the election, the Scottish National Party, the separatists, dominated the vote in Scotland and basically wiped out the Labour Party, which was, Scotland was always a stronghold of the Labour Party and helped it form governments. So Cameron is facing the splintering of the United Kingdom, potentially, and the United Kingdom leaving the EU, which would be a huge issue. So whatever I think about his political skills, if he leaves office, and he said he won't run for re-election mm-hmm. in 5 years, with the United Kingdom still united, and the United Kingdom in the European Union, I think he'll go down as one of the more impressive prime ministers of recent times. But it's very interesting times in British politics, and there are huge questions on the table.
Jane, well, those are big issues. If he does them both, you're right. He'll be looked at as a major prime minister for sure. Barbara, is it deja vu again in Ukraine and Russia and the EU? And it seems like we've been through this before. I mean, there's an attack by the rebels backed by Russia, and of course they deny it, and the Ukrainian government says they've attacked. And I mean, there's a pattern here. I tend to agree. I tend to believe the Ukrainians about what they say. Well, what about all this?
Yeah, look, this is a crisis that never went away. Russia has continued to support forces there. There have continued to be Russian soldiers in eastern Ukraine. At the Atlantic Council, we had a report called Hiding in Plain Sight about how this is done. You know, there are Russian soldiers who take off their Russian uniforms and put on different uniforms. They technically leave the Russian army and join the separatists. And then when they go back, they get all their benefits from the Russian government. The Ukrainian government alleges that there are more than 9,000 Russian soldiers in eastern Ukraine. So it's not just a question of separatists. But there was another spate of fighting near Donetsk, and at least 26 people dead. The worst violation yet of the alleged ceasefire that was reached in February. So, I mean, the timing is such, before a G7 meeting, used to be the G8, but now, of course, Russia is not invited. And as you mentioned, EU sanctions were supposed to expire in July. Now it looks like they'll be renewed. The Russian ruble is sinking again. It's really hard to understand Putin's game in this, because it would seem to me that just keeping it going on a low level would be more in his interest than provoking a major incident like this.
Stephen?
Yeah, as Barbara said, President Obama's heading to the G7 summit this weekend. I think the issue of Russia is going to be a huge issue, especially considering the summits in Germany, and Chancellor Merkel is the prime contact in Europe for this issue. U.S. officials now openly admit that the sanctions regime isn't actually changing Russia's behavior. For much of the past year, they've said that the sanctions regime has to be maintained because it might change Russia's behavior. But short of arming the government to fight the rebels, which the administration says it's not prepared to do, it's difficult to see how any action the West takes is going to change Russia's behavior.
Well, it certainly hasn't so far, but we see this thing where there's some gains and then they have a new ceasefire and the gains are collected by Russia and the rebels in Ukraine. We've seen that over and over again.
Right. It seems to be this endless cycle. I think that Vladimir Putin's calculation is as long as Ukraine is kept out of the Western orbit, his goals to some extent are being satisfied, and he's obviously using the Western sanctions as a political tool back home to bolster his own rule. He remains pretty popular despite the fact that food prices are going through the roof in Russia. Barbara mentioned the ruble has crashed. It's tough times in Russia, but you know, the Russian people historically have weathered plenty of tough times through history, and I don't think this particular episode is going to force Putin's hand.
Well, Barbara, unless you have more to say about this, let's move on to the NSA, the National Security Agency, which has become very controversial, and its role has been weakened by Congress and the president.
I'm not sure I would agree with that. The NSA has enormous powers still, and the administration went along with this change. This is really a minor change when you look at the powers that the NSA still has. I mean, they still have the ability to spy on any kind of communications between foreigners and Americans. They can troll the internet with complete abandon. They have gotten enormous abilities to sweep up and see what we're up to under something called the PRISM program, which uses private information collected from U.S. technology companies. So I would not say that that privacy has really been hugely increased. And of course, as government would point out, they weren't necessarily listening to phone calls. They were they were scooping up the records of phone numbers. And so, you know, they didn't actually sort of delve into it unless they had other reasonable suspicions that one of those numbers was fishy.
Yeah, content wasn't the issue. It was just gathering all this incredible data. I never understood really what the objection to that was, but there was certainly one in the House and the Senate, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell tried to block that from happening, wanted to basically retain current law, and he failed, Stephen.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this, there is starting to be at least some kind of debate about the structure of the national security state that was set up after September 11th attacks in 2001. I don't think there's political momentum yet for completely changing it, but you saw Rand Paul, the Republican presidential candidate, who comes from sort of the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, making political capital out of this. If you look at the polls, it's interesting that younger voters, especially those that came of age after September 11th, and people that tend to be the most infatuated, I guess, with the internet and au fait with technology, are actually against a lot of this NSA stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think the politics of this is changing somewhat, and perhaps future generations are going to be less, and as the memory of September 11th fades, are going to be less comfortable with this kind of NSA snooping. The only other thing I would say about this is it kind of goes back to Donald Rumsfeld, the former defense secretary's known unknowns.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't have known about this unless Edward Snowden, the fugitive intelligence analyst, had leaked all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We also don't know what the NSA has done in the subsequent 2 years since it all came out to change its practices. And, you know, we have no idea what the government is doing, what it's collecting out with these programs.
Well, that's because these are secret programs up until Edward Snowden came along and revealed a lot of them. Let me take a break here, a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and Stephen Collinson. Is the NSA issue just going to continue, Barbara? It seems to be one that has galvanized people a lot more than I would have thought.
Yeah, I think it will. I agree with Stephen that we're sort of in a post-post 9/11 world now. You know, barring some, and knock on wood, major new terrorist attack, most Americans are not feeling terribly threatened. And I think there's more of a concern about loss of privacy. As all of this was happening, there comes news that China has apparently breached the federal government's computer systems and gotten its hands on all sorts of data involving 4 million federal employees. So the concern is more about intrusion into these systems, in a sense, than it is about somebody actually using the material for terrorism. It's exploiting it for commercial purposes, for blackmail. These are the things I think most Americans are worried about. They're worried about losing their credit card information to someone who will abuse it.
Stephen, I understand that young people, why young people are more interested in privacy and so on, and yet we have this well-publicized lone wolf problem where it's not an invasion by ISIS or Al-Qaeda or something like that, but people in the United States who take up and either attempt or succeed in terrorist attacks. And yet that doesn't seem to have affected public opinion.
No, it's interesting. There was a case this week where a man was shot in Boston who was allegedly planning a sort of Islamist-inspired terrorist attack. There have been some incidents on U.S. soil, but so far nothing on the lines of the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris, for example, or some of the incidents that have happened in London. I think probably that until that happens, and senior U.S. officials say it's only a matter of time until there's this kind of attack on U.S. soil, public opinion probably won't reflect that. But there's one interesting angle to this, that is that President Obama's approval ratings on tackling terrorism and ISIS are actually heading downwards. People are beginning to question whether he has a sustainable strategy for that. So I think it's clear that the political winds are changing on this a little bit, at least.
Well, I'm going to start with you, since you're from a soccer fanatic country, about Sepp Blatter, who has been the president of FIFA since 1998, long time, and has not been highly regarded by many other countries of the world, but yet he's been reelected several times. Why did he step down? You know, there were these indictments of former and current FIFA officials, some very close to him, and yet he wasn't, and yet he's leaving.
It's fascinating. You know, what's most interesting about this to me is that it's the United States that's actually leading a cleanup of FIFA. Mm-hmm. I think the figure is something like 6% of Americans say that football or soccer, as you call it here, is their favorite sport. And yet, it's the United States that's handing down indictments and investigating FIFA and giving the Swiss police the opportunity to arrest a lot of these FIFA officials. I think the reason Sepp Blatter was reelected and then resigned, I don't know the reason. So there's two possible possibilities. Either he had some wind that he was the target of this investigation and he was in some kind of legal jeopardy. I think what's more likely is that many of the big sponsors of the World Cup, US companies, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, Visa, I think those companies might have started to make their feelings known that they didn't want to be associated with what many people see as a corrupt organization. It's no surprise to anyone that's sort of watched football that FIFA is being seen as corrupt. Many people have, you know, suspected it of wrongdoing for many years. The problem is that each nation in FIFA gets one vote, and so a lot of these poorer nations are very susceptible to being bribed in return for their vote for the hosting of World Cups, for example. That's how many people believe that the World Cup went to Moscow in 2018, I believe it is, and to Qatar, which is A, not a footballing country, and B, it's ridiculously hot in the summer when they were planning to host the event before they moved it to January and February, how these countries got the World Cup in the first place. So on a global level, this is a massive story, and it looks like it's going to cause a wholesale clean-out of FIFA.
Well, Barbara, what about it? You and I are from a non-soccer fanatic country, and yet the U.S. has played this role, and Loretta Lynch, the new attorney general who headed the investigation in New York, has, at least with the officials around the world who have criticized FIFA over the years, she's a hero.
Yeah, well, as we were talking about before the show, you know, when large sums of money pass through the international banking system, they tend to go through U.S. banks at some point, and that presumably gives the U.S. jurisdiction. I mean, this is massive. They're talking about $150 million in bribes, $10 million to one guy from Trinidad Tobago alone to vote for South Africa's 2010 World Cup bid. Clearly, there was a lot of controversy over awarding the games to the Russians and especially to Qatar. And one of the questions now is whether those decisions will be revisited in light of these allegations. I think it probably depends on what comes out in the various trials or whether there's a big plea bargain that sweeps a lot of this under the rug. But something like 14 officials now, there are arrest warrants for at least 14 officials. So this certainly will have a major impact, I think, on this organization. U.S. is not soccer crazy yet, but the numbers are going up. And if you recall World Cup in Brazil, I mean, at least here in Washington, there were a lot of people who watched those games. I, myself included, I watched about maybe six or seven matches, which I'd never done before. And, of course, the kids, you know, all play soccer now when they're little, various soccer leagues around the country. So I think there really is an interest in this here.
Stephen, the conventional wisdom is that somehow FIFA will not challenge Russia in 2018. It would be too big a flap, and obviously Putin has already criticized the United States for these indictments. But Qatar, it seems that that was what really has triggered, not these indictments, but this huge dissatisfaction internationally with FIFA, more than anything else, for the reasons you cited, that there must be something fishy about their getting it because it's not a soccer country and it's incredibly hot. And
right, I mean, most of the established soccer countries didn't want to go to Qatar in the first place. First of all, because of the heat, there are all sorts of questions about the number of workers that have died building these stadiums in Qatar. Another angle is that alcohol is actually banned in Qatar.
It's
a Muslim country. You know, and it sounds funny, but alcohol is a, you know, the fans go to the games.
Yeah.
They meet up and drink beforehand. Mm-hmm. They drink afterwards. Mm-hmm. So the fans aren't in favor of it. And what happened this year is that FIFA decided, okay, we're not going to play this in the summer because it's too hot. So we're going to play it in January and February. And that means that all the European leagues have to shut down for 2 months. So there's very few countries that are actually in favor of holding the World Cup in Qatar. And I wouldn't be surprised at all to see it moved.
I would not be at all surprised myself to see it moved. And I hope it happens. But look, time for another break. We'll be right back with Issues in the News.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and Stephen Collinson. Barbara, Hillary Clinton's a prohibitive favorite, and despite some troubles now, it still is for the Democratic presidential nomination. But polls have showed her basically just a tiny bit ahead of Republican candidates, at least ones like Rand Paul, who we talked about in the, earlier, and Scott Walker, a governor of Wisconsin, and Marco Rubio, a senator from Florida. But her polls have been rather precipitous in dropping, and particularly on the question of trust, which is something kind of hard to deal with. But in two polls this past week, respondents were asked whether she was honest and trustworthy. In the CNN poll, 57% said no. And in an ABC Washington Post poll, 52% said no. This does not mean that she's headed for defeat by any means. But what about Hillary Clinton and her campaign?
Well, look, as you point out, there's been an impact from a number of things. The email scandal, she had her own email server, although as we were saying earlier, perhaps now we understand why, given how insecure government servers appear to be. And there's also the Clinton Foundation and the obscene amounts of money that were donated by governments and corporations and individuals who had some sort of business before the U.S. government when Hillary was serving as Secretary of State. And this all gives a kind of seedy, seamy sort of look to the Clinton family and to Hillary Clinton. On the other hand, she has enormous strengths, and she is delivering speech after speech on key policy issues that have direct appeal to many, many potential voters. Just the other day, she gave a major speech where she said that every American, when they reach the age of 18, should be automatically registered to vote. And this is a way to deal with the fact that young people, poor people, people of color, immigrants often do not register for various reasons and so are not really represented when it comes time to vote. This is, of course, not exactly disinterested, since most of these voters would probably vote for a Democrat in national elections, but it's still, it's a very strong stance. She's also talked about mass incarceration of African Americans, people from poor communities. So she's kind of staking out very important progressive positions on issues that matter. And I think we're just going to have to see, as the campaign really gets going, how the substance of what she says will stack up against these this sort of unpleasant odor that comes from the activities of the Clinton Foundation.
Well, that's a good question that Barbara raises. I personally don't think she can continue very much longer not answering questions. I mean, these issues of the emails, now a judge says that the State Department has to start turning out batches of them every month, and it seems every week a new issue comes up in the whole thing about the Clinton Foundation. I see there was one with Sweden in which Bill Clinton got a speech for $750,000. I've given speeches for pay. That would be, for me, that would be good for 2 or 3 years.
Two or three years, oh, my God.
Oh, I'll take some of that.
Yeah. Jeez, do me for a decade.
Maybe closer to a decade. And then Sweden, at least Ericsson, a big company in Sweden, it had some dealings with Iran and didn't want to be designated as a violator of the sanctions against Iran. Anyway, what about Hillary?
You know, I tend to think that Americans have made up their mind about the Clintons long ago. That's one of the advantages she has of being so well known, is that Bill Clinton was impeached when he was president, for example. And this is one of those kind of classic Clinton scandals where everything looks completely dodgy, but there's no real smoking gun to condemn them, so they kind of get away with it. I think it's a problem for Hillary Clinton, presuming she wins the Democratic nomination in a general election. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in Iowa and New Hampshire in recent months. I've yet to find anybody that's enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton's campaign, but she's basically got no competition. I mean, she has Bernie Sanders, who's a self-declared independent socialist, who could actually, I think, have the potential to wound her in Iowa, for example, in the caucuses and even in New Hampshire, but he's not going to beat her for the Democratic nomination. I think what this does is, if Hillary Clinton were to become president, it seems to me that we're going to go back to the kind of scandal ridden administrations plagued by secrecy, allegations of wrongdoing that we saw during the Clinton campaign. I think that people who are going to vote Democrat are going to vote Democrat whatever, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton is running. And it's a pretty much divided political nation in the United States. I don't think it's going to have a tangible electoral impact, but I think it could have a very serious impact on a Hillary Clinton presidency.
You know, one thing I've been struck by, Barbara, is that, and I regard it as sort of opposites attracting, you know, a husband and wife. And here you have Bill Clinton, the most natural mm-hmm. politician, a great speaker, charming guy. I mean, people, you see him, I mean, he can work a room, a stadium, for heaven's sakes, sure. Better than anybody. And then his wife, Hillary, is a little bit stiff, not a particularly good speaker. I mean, obviously, she's a serious person, but, I mean, they are so different, and I think that hurts Hillary a little. I mean, people see Bill being such a great politician, and she's just not in that class.
Well, I think she's getting there. She's improving. I just mentioned one other poll result that mm-hmm. I thought was interesting.
Okay.
Her share of Democrats' support, this is the CNN poll, has slipped from 69% to 60%. And number two is somebody who hasn't even declared, and that's Joe Biden. Vice mm-hmm. President Joe Biden is at 14%. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we say that she's inevitable, but there mm-hmm. are other people out there.
There are.
Who could step in if she falters. And, of course, poor Joe Biden now is getting a very large sympathy vote because of the death of his eldest son too. Mm-hmm. to cancer. So she's not the only one out there. We made a mistake in 2008. People thought she was inevitable, and mm-hmm. she turned out not to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not going to be a coronation. You know, before the idea had been sort of there'd be a coronation of Hillary on the Democratic side and a demolition derby among Republicans for their nomination. Well, that's still possible, a demolition derby. I mean, so far, Republicans have been not particularly rough on each other. And Republicans really start getting nasty as when people are cut out of debates. They have so many candidates. They all can't be in a televised debates, which start in August. And those who aren't, will not like it, and let us know. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Stephen Collinson, Senior Reporter at CNN Politics. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.